You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of April 2016 on Monocle 24.
On today's show, as Barack Obama once again cast doubt on the US's role in Libya, calling it the worst mistake of his presidency, my guests, Jane Kinnamont and Martin Plaut, will be discussing whether that's really the case. We'll also be talking about the day's other top news stories from Japan to South Africa, here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are the journalist Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London, and Jane Kinnamont, who's senior research fellow and deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome both to the show. Barack Obama has said that both for fans and critics, he's made one big mistake that they will all notice, and that is Libya. But this is exactly what he said on the conservative-lined US news channel Fox News yesterday while discussing his country's involvement in Libya with anchor Chris Wallace.
Worst mistake?
Probably failing to plan for the day after what I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya.
Martin, a simple question. Is he right that was his worst mistake, do you think?
It's a fascinating question. One really would have to look very carefully at all the issues that he's tried to tackle. I mean, Guantanamo Bay, you know, must be up there with it, not pushing it harder earlier. It's a tough one to know whether it's the right, whether it is the worst. It was certainly a bad one. But then, who has ever managed to put a nation together again? You know, there's the old Humpty Dumpty problem. You know, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. And that goes back to the English Civil War. So we've known this for a very, very long time. It's easier to put a country apart than it is to put it together again. And so, yes, it was a big one. But what alternative did they have?
And I guess also when you compare it to, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, two other places where the US has intervened in recent years, neither of those countries are properly back together again either, are they?
No, but I mean, you know, I suppose one could look at Ukraine. And I mean, were there mistakes made there? Or did he go too hard against the Russians? I mean, the trouble is, you know, as Mao Zedong is supposed to have said about, when asked about the French Revolution, about what he thought about it, whether it was a good or a bad thing. He said, well, it's too early to tell. And that was, after all, a couple of hundred years later. It takes a long time to know whether things are really a big mistake. So I think we're far too premature to make a real serious judgment.
Jane, as Martin says, there's a long list that he could have potentially chosen from. Why do you think that Libya kind of sticks in his mind as such a kind of a catastrophe?
Well, for one thing, it's had a particular resonance in American domestic politics because of the partisan fallout over the assassination of the American ambassador there. For another, it is an area where his foreign policy repeated the mistakes that he criticised his predecessor for. So he came into office on an anti-war, let's get out of Iraq ticket. And in Libya, of course, the US was only one of many parties that were involved in the no-fly zone, but it may be an area where he thinks, actually, we intervened when we shouldn't have, and we repeated those mistakes. But ironically, I think for many, many people in the Arab world, Syria is far more of a weak point for the US. There are some who think he should have intervened. There are some who think he should have intervened less. But the conflict there is much larger and much more dangerous.
And Jane, what do you think? Only a few weeks ago, he gave an interview to The Atlantic in which he said that he felt David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, had been distracted during Libya and was partly to blame, therefore, for the outcome in Libya. Now, here he is saying it's his responsibility. Do you feel that in a way that he picked this because he's already made it clear that he doesn't feel all the blame lies at his door is maybe not the most genuine of answers in some sense?
I think there's something in that. I think it's like when one is asked in a job interview what one's biggest weakness is and you're desperately trying to pick something that isn't your biggest weakness. Certainly it was the UK and France that were at the forefront of intervention in Libya. And of course, the Libyan opposition did not want to be like the Iraqi opposition. They pushed back very strongly against foreign countries having any kind of occupation of the country. They said that they didn't want much foreign advice and so forth. So it wasn't just a mistake of the US.
Martin, I also, maybe I'm being a little bit suspicious here, but he's kind of drawing the flak to himself for this at a time when, Hillary Clinton, he wants to win the election, become the next president, I have no doubt. And she has taken a lot of flak for what happened in Libya herself with the attack on the embassy. Now, do you think he's also drawing some fire himself deliberately? He's saying, this was on my watch, this was my responsibility.
That's a fascinating thought. I must admit, I hadn't thought of that one. But let me ask Jane perhaps a different question, since I don't know the answer to that, which is, what would have happened if the West hadn't intervened? Mm. I mean, were the predictions of the, massacre and the slaughter that the Gaddafi forces were going to inflict on the people, were they real?
I think they were justified fears. It was certainly a regime that didn't show much compunction when dealing with the population. But there was, at that time, also a sense that if Gaddafi is allowed to get away with putting down an uprising violently, that will put paid to hopes for democracy right across the Middle East. And of course, that happened anyway, because Assad basically took the same strategy. So Libya did not send a wider lesson to the region about being unable to use force to crush one's own population. It was a very specific case where there was an opportunity because Gaddafi had basically no friends in the international arena. They were able to cobble together an international consensus around the no-fly zone. But then it was very clear to Russia, China and others that that would not be repeated anywhere else, especially in Syria.
Jane, bring Spree up to speed now. What do you feel there's hope, though, for Libya? Because we have this new government installed in Tripoli. Now, it hasn't brought in every faction. The government in the west of the country has said it's unlikely to join. And I think there's been threats any minister who kind of does join will be in trouble with the Western administration. But enticing them to, in the end, come to some deal are two facts. That they have ISIS in the south of the country getting near to them that could threaten them. And two, if they do get a deal going, there's a huge amount of wealth and an embargoed money that's available to all of those squabbling factions to get their hands on. Do you think there is, for good or bad, an opportunity here?
It's very deeply divided, and the UN-backed government doesn't necessarily enjoy much buy-in or much legitimacy on the ground. But I think, to take your point about sort of counterfactual history further, Libya would have run into difficulties at some point with the transition away from Gaddafi. It might have come much later at the time of his death. But this is a country where systematically institutions were weakened. The entire system has been made to depend on the ruler. The army was largely set up as a Praetorian guard to defend him. And so you've seen, without him, all forms of authority really fragment. You still have an estimated 300 different militias operating on the ground, and they operate largely under two big coalitions. But it's going to take a very long time before they are brought into any lasting peace settlement, let alone disarmed. And while the oil money should be an incentive for economic cooperation, it also means that there's a lot of quite lucrative spoils for people to squabble over and fight over.
Martin, just before we leave this topic, Barack Obama has done many interesting things during his presidency. He seems to have taken the last kind of year to be a bit freer and a bit more outspoken and push through all sorts of things. What's your feeling about his legacy? Do you feel that he will leave the White House as a great a great leader?
Great leader is perhaps strong, but somebody, I mean, I think if his health care lasts and survives his legacy, his passing from the presidency, then he will be truly seen as a great man to have brought this about. I mean, it is something that, after all, the Clintons failed to produce. It's been something that people needed for many, many years. If that is embedded in American society, it would change the whole relationship between the citizen and the state, and that would be enormous.
And Jane, do you think he got more things right than wrong?
It's a tough call. I'm focused very much on foreign policy, but clearly the US is left very divided over his legacy. He has been a somewhat less centrist president than Clinton managed to be, and we're now seeing this huge fallout and backlash from the Republican voters. So again, the outcome of the next few years is going to make that clearer, I think.
Except, of course, he did have the one, he was born, disadvantage he was born with, that was the colour of his skin. Mm. For some Republicans, that was abhorrent.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to move to Japan and Hiroshima now, but we stay on the topic of US foreign policy. Today, the US Secretary of State, John Kerry, accompanied fellow G7 foreign ministers from nations such as the UK, Canada, France, Germany, Italy and Japan to the city's memorial for the US's 1945 nuclear attacks. The rhetoric from Kerry was reflective. He referred to the memorial as gut-wrenching, but Kerry, of course, stopped short of issuing any apology for the attack. It remains the only nation to have dropped nuclear bombs during combat, and Kerry also emphasised the need to continue to rid the world of nuclear weapons. Let's play a clip of him.
Going through this museum was a reminder of the depth of obligation that every single one of us in public life carries. In fact, every person in position of responsibility carries to work for peace. And I'll jump ahead of any question that one of you might ask. It is also why any suggestion by any candidate for high public office that we should be building more weapons and giving them to a country like Korea or Japan are absurd on their face and run counter to everything that every president, Republican or Democrat alike, has tried to achieve ever since World War II.
Martin, you're rolling your eyes slightly, I think it's fair to say, at that speech. What strikes you as discordant there?
Well, what's so extraordinary is the idea that the Americans would say we shouldn't give weapons to Japan. I mean, you know, they have the Chinese right on their sort of on their doorstep, on their lapping. You know, you have the South China Sea, which is a major confrontation now between all the nations of the region and the Chinese. The idea that America will not go on arming the Japanese to make sure that the Chinese do not just grab the whole region is extraordinary.
But Jane, isn't this partly also saying there needs to be more than weapons? I guess he's saying, yes, it's fine to supply weapons, but there's been some hint from, you know, the likes of Trump, you know, that alliances are unimportant. We're not going to come in and fight on your side. Maybe he's more saying weapons are not enough. We need to be present in these countries. We need to be present in the region.
Mm. Well, I think it's very specifically about the impact of nuclear weapons. And, you know, it is important that having seen the horrendous impact that they had, that the world has not yet got to a situation where they've been used again. But there can't be any complacency about that lasting. And I think for, you know, the generation that grew up during the Cold War, they lived with the very real fear of what that would mean. For the new generations, it could be that these things become a little bit trivialised, that people actually forget and don't take them so seriously. So I think it's about the very specific nature of these weapons and not about whether
there should
be smaller
weapons. And it comes just at a time
when
we saw in North Korea at the weekend this is suggestion that, you know, they were saying that the regime was saying they're not that far off having a nuclear weapon that they claim would be able to hit the US. So for the US, it's a very real and current argument.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's been a major issue also with Iran. Iran argued to its own people for a long time that basically it's fundamentally hypocritical of the US to say we can have these weapons and others can't, and that was a popular argument, just as in Pakistan having a nuclear weapon, despite it being against international law, was a popular argument. But ultimately the US was able to get together an international consensus against non-proliferation, where even Iran's allies felt that it wasn't a good idea for them also to have nuclear weapons. So again, they'll be hoping to reinforce that perhaps their best hope with regard to North Korea is that China will rein it in rather than that it will somehow be influenced by the US.
Martin, there's certainly been a spread of nuclear weapons in recent years. India, Pakistan, Iran may have stopped. It does seem that the North Koreans will probably be equipped with a long-range nuclear missile in the years to come. What do you think that Kerry's moral argument is here? Because it always seems to, you know, anti-campaigners, slightly tricky for one country to say other countries should not have them, but we should. Is he on strong moral ground, do you think?
I think it's an extremely difficult issue to look at. But, you know, the thing one mustn't forget about weapons is that the deaths in the post-war period have not been produced by even if one added in the nuclear weapons that were used at the end of the war, I mean, they were trivial by comparison with the number of people who've been killed. I mean, if you just think of the Iran-Iraq war, a million dead. If you think of the Rwandan genocide, 800,000 people chopped to bits with knives. I mean, you know, you don't need an atom bomb to kill people. And there's one other thing that's worth pointing out, and there's a good reason why Kerry should not have apologized. First of all, the Americans didn't start the war. It was the Japanese who started the war with the unprovoked attack on Pearl Harbor. The second thing was that the Americans had lost 292,000 men by the time the bombs were dropped. They calculate that at least that number would have been required to pacify or end the war by taking the Japanese mainland, possibly twice that number. Now, if I'd been the American president, I wouldn't have hesitated to use the bomb again, the nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because there was no other way of ending the war without losing at least the same number of men. I wouldn't have waited.
Jane, while an apology would have been unlikely and may not even be, you know, desirable or required, it's interesting it's taken so long for a foreign secretary to be able to go there, a secretary of state rather, to go there and be able to visit this shrine and acknowledge even what happened there in Hiroshima.
I think that's also about generational change, you know, and the passing of a generation of people that were actually fighting in that war who would have in the past found it quite difficult to see this kind of visit take place on both sides.
But do you think that any apology will ever be due for this?
I think it's something highly unlikely to come for all the reasons that you outline. And I think apologies are often also secured through politics. And I think it's something that future Japanese governments would find it pretty hard to lobby for.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Martin Plaut and Jane Kinnamont. Coming up next, how much longer will Jacob Zuma hold on to power in South Africa?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. Doesn't matter how long I'm here, there's always something new. It's a very, it's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. There's more to discover all the time. And also there's so much that's new in Tokyo. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on. So there's always something to keep us interested.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Martin Plaut and Jane Kinnamont. Embattled South African President Jacob Zuma, who was recently found to have violated the nation's constitution by failing to pay back £11 million worth of government money used to decorate his house, is facing fierce opposition from all sides. The country's leader has also been accused of letting wealthy business magnates, the Gupta brothers, have undue influence in South African politics, and those two brothers have reportedly just left the country. Well, the latest group to call out Zuma's murky political practices is the Board of Trustees from the Charitable Foundation for that great South African icon, Nelson Mandela. Martin, is it looking bad for Jacob Zuma?
It's looking bad, but probably not terminal yet, because the people who are attacking him now are the good, the great and the good. So, as you say, you have the Mandela Foundation, you have his old buddies like Ahmed Kathrada, Dennis Goldberg, a whole host of church leaders. Even the South African Communist Party has sort of shuffled its feet and Britain looked unhappy. But at the end of the day, he depends on his own party and the party branches. And if the party branches came out against him, there's a critical meeting which is going on right now in Gauteng, in the Johannesburg area. If they and enough of the other branches come out against him, then he's in trouble. I mean, he has been weakened, his authority has been reduced, but in trouble, we don't know.
And Martin, what led him into this position? Is it because the ANC is all-powerful and in a way you're not that answerable to anyone? What's led to this kind of feeling that, you know, he could spend all this money and think that he would get away with it?
Well, somebody who gave me an insight into this was one of his friends who knew him in exile during the liberation struggle against apartheid. And they said what he used to do is he would arrive in an area and sort out all the political messes that there were, you know, in Mozambique, in Swaziland, wherever there was a problem. And he was a brave man. I mean, nobody can take that away from him. But he didn't, he was absolutely had no interest whatsoever in finances. And he would just expect everybody to pick up the tab, whatever it was. He sort of had, he treated himself like royalty. You know, he didn't carry money with him. That was not his issue. He was a politician and he would solve the political issues. And he's always looked at this the same way. He just thinks that, you know, money is there for him to use. He is running the country. He's doing the difficult job. Just look after me. And that's the way he looks at these things.
Jane, do you think there's an element here of people feeling they get power and they want to redress, you know, past injustices? They feel, in a sense, that, you know, white people ran this country for a long time, gained huge amounts of things, and there's nothing wrong with them kind of doing the same in reverse. It feels like they're equaling the playing field, they're pushing out money to make black people wealthy. That they feel that, you know, even when I see some of the comments from ordinary South Africans in the papers today, there was a sense that, you know, don't blame all these people. There are other people still in the background, white families, oligarchs still controlling our country. This isn't really the cause of trouble.
I think there has been growing criticism in South Africa about the tendency of the redistribution in the post-apartheid times to benefit a small minority. So initially, the ANC set about a programme of black economic empowerment, saying that companies had to have a certain number of black people on their boards and so forth. And then gradually, they found that a very small number of very wealthy people were benefiting from that. And so they moved to broadly based black economic empowerment, which was supposed to widen the base. But it hasn't really worked. The education system's still very weak. 25% unemployment. You know, your prospects are pretty weak if you're a young person growing up in today's South Africa. And you may not now remember apartheid, you know. So I think the ANC will face growing criticism from people who don't remember the old days, but certainly there will be people who try to blame everybody else and try to find scapegoats to cover up their own corruption.
And explain to us about the Guptas, a fascinating family. We understand that they've left for Lucknow, where their kind of traditional base was. They've gone back to India on their private jet, maybe via Dubai. They may even be in Dubai at this time. But how did this family become so important and so powerful in South Africa?
Well, it's a very good question. They arrived in 1993, so just about the time of transition from apartheid to post-apartheid, and with not much. They had some money, and they set up a computer firm called Sahara, and they used what is essentially a standard, bog-standard model. Find a politician who's on the rise, get in bed with him, I don't mean literally, but, you know, sort of metaphorically, and as he rises, you look after his money, and he looks after your connections. And it worked a treat. Zuma absolutely loved this. And so the Guptas gave all sorts of his wife and members of his family jobs and largesse and all the rest of it. And he was expected to look after them. And so that, to the point where a few years ago, when they wanted to have one of their family members married, they brought a 747 from India, flew it in, and they wanted to close down the main airport, the Oliver Tambo Airport in Johannesburg, just so that they could land. And the airport said, you've got to be joking. And so they said, well, we'll go to Waterkloof, which is near Pretoria, which is the military airbase. And the defense minister said, you've got to be joking, we're not going to close it. And they just got number one, as it was called. Now, we have no idea who number one was, to authorize it, and number one did. And they then landed, they closed the airbase, landed the airplane, and had a, I think it was 200 car sort of motorcade with blue flashing lights to Sun City, where they then got married. Now, this shows how much power these people had. They also got to a point where they actually were interviewing people to be ministers. They were appointing ministers. Now, this is just, you know, way beyond anything that the Constitution could possibly allow. And this is why people have just got, in South Africa, there's a term, they were gutful with them. You know, they were just fed up.
Jane, just before we move on, is there a sense that, you know, the revolution, the change that we saw, you know, under under Nelson Mandela is restarted again now? Because it feels like when we look at what's happening in the universities, with a feeling that, you know, it's time to stop speaking Afrikaans in universities, that black people don't want to speak the language anymore. There feels to be, you know, the youth wing of the ANC kind of pulling in a different direction. There seem to be many more outspoken voices in the newspapers and magazines. And here we have, again, some sense, you know, that there's something a bit kind of rotten going on. It feels like South Africa may take a leap in a different direction for good or bad. I wonder if you felt that there was, again, a generational thing. Mm. Maybe just younger people, there's something going on that's changing South Africa again, and maybe not in the way that the West would have liked, but a way that maybe African people would like.
The economic inequalities still remain fundamentally unaddressed. So South Africa has been praised all over the world for its truth and reconciliation system that dealt with some of the political crimes of the past. But it is still a highly unequal country. Land is another massive issue. There are still many people thinking that there should be some kind of land reform, although, of course, foreign investors and so forth will be really pressing the government not to go ahead with things like that. And the ANC is going to find it more difficult to keep a lid on things, as, you know, anyone who was 22 or under was not alive in the time of apartheid. And gradually they'll lose respect for the achievements that it made.
Well, we're going to move on now to our final story. London's skyline has received its fair share of abuse in recent years. We're now stuck with all number of gherkins, shards, walkie-talkies, and there's more to come. But what if we could make tall buildings from a softer, less intrusive material, such as timber? Would we like them differently? Well, that's the hope of a newly proposed plan from PRP Architecture and researchers from the University of Cambridge. They want to build London's first wooden skyscraper, a 300-metre tall tower made from wood that would sit amid the city's Barbican housing estate. Martin, at first a fanciful idea, but I was looking around today. There is many tall buildings finally being built from timber. They've discovered that timber is just as strong and used in the correct way. And there's something about timber that we respond to in a much nicer way than steel and, you know, tough materials. Does this idea appeal to you?
Oh, enormously. I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, I'm not sure we really want a building as quite as high as this. I mean, it'd be second tallest building in London. I think we have enough tall buildings. But the idea of building in wood and its strength is, I think, stunning. I mean, a friend of mine put up a green oak barn, which is made when you put them in when they are green, and they literally bolt them together with wooden stakes. It's an ancient practice. And when they twist against each other, and they actually form bonds which are stronger than steel. And as long as they are, fireproofed and made good, there's absolutely no reason why they can't be structurally sound. So I think it's a fantastic idea.
And I've heard that actually timber, if it burns so slowly when treated, that it can be stronger than even metal. Metal can bust and crack absolutely under heat quicker than wood. Jane, when you look at our skyline, we do see so many of these towers which have kind of, you know, no kind of, you know, public realm at the bottom of them. They're all plate glass. There's something that rebounds us when we kind of almost go along them. You go to high streets, which are all plate glass. They're not very emotionally appealing. There's been really good research done that shows that when you're around timber, if you have timber rooms in hospitals, it kind of makes you feel better. There's something really ancient about wood that we connect to in an interesting way. Again, when you look at our skyline and when you see these buildings, does it give you a kind of a feeling of warmth when you see the potential for a wooden tower block?
One of the strengths that London has is it's got a very high volume of green space per square metre. And I think the love that Londoners show for the parks really does speak to the natural desire that people have to be somewhere that feels more natural, feels a bit more closer to earth. But it is 350 years since the middle of London burnt down because it was made of timber. So all that health and safety would need to be taken quite seriously.
Well, it's a marvellous plan. You can go online and see those buildings. It's on also a website called Dezeem, which is all about the world of architecture. So check that out. But that's all we have time for on the show today. My special thanks to Martin Plant and also to Jane Kinnamont for joining me here on Midori House. Today's show, it was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Maria Grenina. And our studio manager was Chris Grimes. We have more music coming up next. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture with Robert Bound. I've just looked through the glass and it's Chris Chilvers, not Chris Grimes. I don't know why I was given that information. And tune in at 2200 hours London time for more on the day's top stories on the Monocle Daily, of course. This show, well, it's back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. And also, if you're a subscriber to The Urbanist, there's a new show out today called Tall Stories, a 5-minute treat on a Monday morning. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye.